on RN and online at abc.net.au/RN. You're with Big Ideas. Thanks for joining me. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Tonight, Clive Hamilton asks, can human beings survive the Anthropocene? The Earth's 4.5 billion year history is officially divided into geological time periods. Terms like the Jurassic, Cretaceous, and Pleistocene are known to many of us. Officially, for the past 10,000 years, the Earth has been in the Holocene epoch, marked by a mild and unusually stable climate. But there are now calls to create a new geological age, the Anthropocene, the age of humans. The argument is that the human imprint on the global environment has become so large it rivals the great forces of nature. Tonight on Big Ideas, Clive Hamilton discusses the current condition of the planet, the threat posed by climate change, and whether geoengineering is a viable or appropriate response. Clive Hamilton is Professor of Public Ethics at Charles Sturt University. In May this year, he delivered the third annual Dr. Eric Dark Memorial Lecture as part of the Sydney Writers' Festival.
So, can humans survive the Anthropocene? Well, imagine we could weigh all of the animals on the Earth's land surfaces. And the creatures could be divided into three categories. Wild animals, domesticated animals, so wild animals covering everything from elephants and camels and polar bears and rabbits and kangaroos and wolves. Domesticated animals, cows, sheep, pigs, cats, dogs. And the third category, human beings. And if we weighed them all, worked out the mass measured in millions of tons, what do you think would be the percentages falling into each of these three classes, wild, domesticated, and human? Well, a Canadian scientist, Václav Smil, has performed the calculation, and it turns out that humans account for 30% of the total mass of all animals, and domesticated animals account for 67%. So that leaves all wild animals on the Earth's surface accounting for no more than 3% of the total. In the words of Smil, the zoomass of wild vertebrates is now vanishingly small compared to the biomass of domestic animals. So wildlife documentaries showing vast herds of wildebeest sweeping across the plains are really quite misleading, as are the Attenborough films that leave us with the impression that there are many remote places out there where wildlife thrives. Humans have radically changed not only the relative mass of wild creatures, but also their distribution around the globe, driving out species from where they traditionally live and bringing exotic ones wherever humans go. Scientists now believe that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction in the history of life on planet Earth, a mass extinction being a period in Earth's history when abnormally large numbers of species die out simultaneously or within a limited time frame. And at present, it's estimated the rate of extinction is now 100 to 1,000 times faster than the natural background rate due to human impact. The transformative impact of human activity on the globe can be illustrated in many ways. Each year, humans shift 10 times more rock and soil around the Earth than do the great natural processes of erosion and weathering. But the greatest impact, of course, due to humans is human-induced climate change. For 200 years, humans have been putting into the atmosphere carbon that, in the form of coal and oil, had lain immobile for millions of years beneath the ground. Over time, most of the extra carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere will be absorbed by the oceans as carbonic acid, rendering them more acidic. Since the start of the Industrial Revolution, the acidity of the world's oceans has increased by about 30%. And this change in the chemical composition of the world's oceans is effectively permanent. It's expected to have profound effects on marine life because it makes it harder for calcification to occur, affecting corals, oysters and crustaceans like crabs and krill. We can't isolate the climate system from the other components of the Earth system. We're discovering, at least Earth system scientists are, that changes in the atmosphere affect not just the weather, but also the Earth's hydrosphere, the watery parts, the biosphere, living creatures, and even the lithosphere, the Earth's crust, the outer layer of the geosphere, the Earth, the solid rock of the Earth as a planet. And these spheres are all linked by the great natural cycles and processes that make the Earth a dynamic entity. In short, with global warming, not merely the climate, but everything is in play. As geologist Bill Maguire put it, who wrote the book on the impacts of climate change on the lithosphere, he wrote, "So complex and entangled is the Earth system that, looking to the future, nothing can be regarded as immune to the influence of anthropogenic warming." So profound has been the influence of humans that Earth system scientists have recently proposed that the Earth has entered a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, the age of humans, defined by the fact that the human imprint on the global environment has now become so large and active that it rivals some of the great forces of nature in its impact on the functioning of the Earth system. It has to be stressed that we're not simply describing the further spread of human impact across the landscape or the oceans. We're talking about a shift in the nature of the human relationship to the Earth as a whole. Earth scientist James Savitsky has written, "At some point we graduated from adapting our environment to making it adapt to us. But now we regularly decelerate and accelerate natural processes, focus energy in extraordinary ways, and alter, destroy, or create ecosystems." So the Anthropocene is not defined by the broadening impact of humans on the environment, but by the active human interference in the processes that govern the geological evolution of the planet. The arrival of the Anthropocene is usually dated from the end of the 18th century, that is, the start of the Industrial Revolution in Europe, when greenhouse gas emissions began their modern upward trajectory and the human population began to expand. More recently, Earth system scientists have identified the years immediately following the Second World War as the start of what they call the Great Acceleration, a point of inflection at which growth rates of consumption, resource use, and waste generation shifted onto a much steeper path. This chart is one why I'm insistent, actually, on having a PowerPoint presentation at a writers' festival. And you can see that the Anthropocene, which began a few decades ago, or at most a couple of centuries ago, marks the end of the previous geological epoch known as the Holocene, a 10,000-year period of remarkable climatic stability and clemency. And the Holocene was preceded by hundreds of thousands of years of climatic chaos. Now, modern humans have been around for perhaps 200,000 years. For the first 190,000 or so years, the weather was extremely changeable, a jagged history of ice ages, little ice ages, and usually short warming periods, with massive ice sheets at times covering most of the northern hemisphere, then retreating for short or long periods of a few thousand years before returning to drive human populations to a precarious existence in the cold or epic migrations towards the equator. Although humans survived these wild swings, at times, populations were decimated, but some 10,000 years ago, the climate stabilised around an average temperature very close to the modern one prior to the influence of industrialism. The Holocene's mild and unusually stable climate permitted human civilization to flourish. Settled agriculture, impossible in the climatic gyrations of previous times, emerged. Some 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, in the so-called cradle of civilization, that is, the river valleys that drain into the Persian Gulf, the new conditions permitted not only settled communities and agriculture, but the development of the wheel, writing, mathematics, legal codes, centralized government, and social strata. In other words, the fundamental features of modern societies. It was the Holocene, this extraordinary 10,000 period of climatic stability, that made civilization possible. In the Holocene, humans were able to free themselves from the dictates of nature and to flourish on the earth. Now we are told that the Holocene's halcyon millennia have come to an end. Humans have flourished so successfully in the sympathetic environment of the last 10,000 years that we have shifted the Earth's geological arc. So we're entering what's known as a hypothermal, an interval marked by a massive increase in atmospheric carbon and the hot, sticky and volatile world that goes with it. Once again, natural processes, now in fact a new natural human hybrid, will drive wild swings in the climate. Well, the Anthropocene was first so named by an atmospheric chemist, Paul Crutzen, who won the 1995 Nobel Prize for his work on the hole in the ozone layer, actually on the chemistry of the ozone layer. And you'll note that this new geological epoch was named by an atmospheric chemist, not by a geologist or a paleoontologist, which alerts us to the fact that the new geological epoch is like no other episode in Earth's 4.5 billion year history. All previous geological divisions have been identified by digging down into the rock strata. The evidence for the Anthropocene, on the other hand, is not to be found in the rock strata, at least not yet, but in the atmosphere, the oceans, the soils, and the biota. Now, the Earth's 4.5 billion year history is officially divided into ages, epochs, periods, eras, and eons, according to a range of criteria developed by geologists and marked on the geological timescale, a scale which is approved officially by the International Commission on Stratigraphy. And, of course, bits of it are familiar to us in terms like the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, and the Pleistocene. The Commission, the International Commission on Stratigraphy, has established an Anthropocene working group to write a report on whether the new epoch should be officially added to the scale. The Commission never takes decisions in a hurry. Many geologists want to establish new epochs on the basis of their discoveries, and so they're very cautious and methodical in making their decisions, and they've appointed an Anthropocene working group to write a report, which I think will be finished in the next year or two, and then they'll take another couple of years to consider it and then make a formal decision. Well, what are the implications of all of this? Well, the Chicago historian Deepesh Chakrabarty, who in fact did his PhD at the Australian National University, Chakrabarty has pointed out that the distinction that we have always drawn between natural history, slow processes that occur on a scale of millions of years, and human history, a series of events that occur on the scale of years or decades or at most centuries, these two histories, natural and human, have now converged. The distinction between human history and geological history, since humans became a geological force, has now collapsed. What does it mean for humankind to inscribe itself into geological time, into deep history? If, since the dawn of the modern era, we've thought of ourselves as creatures of culture, what does it mean when culture becomes so potent that it interferes with the great processes of nature that make the planet a dynamic entity? We've always understood the natural world as a thin layer of living things and the systems that support them, soils, atmosphere, water, a kind of thin layer spread over a large ball of rock. It's now more accurate to understand nature as a kind of furry skin covering a spherical beast that's been slumbering in the sun's warmth for a long time. 10,000 years, perhaps. Now, it's not easy to shift our understanding of the Earth from the idea that it's a static ball of rock covered by a thin layer of biological fuzz to a deeper conception of it as a total entity in a constant state of flux, one in which humans have now become the dominant process. Well, the arrival of the Anthropocene has some far-reaching implications for environmentalism. Let me begin with an apparently unquestionable assertion. At the heart of modern environmentalism is the idea that the planet must be saved from further damage by humanity. Now, this seems uncontroversial. Yet environmentalism, at least that part of it that stays close to the emerging science of Earth systems, is undergoing a radical transformation that renders this statement untrue. And this is because the conception of the planet on which modern environmentalism was founded has now been turned on its head by Earth system science. In its early days, the science of ecology showed how easily complex ecosystems could be degraded and species obliterated. In 1962, by observing the damage to humans and nature caused by factories and industrial agriculture, Rachel Carson, in her landmark book Silent Spring, presented nature as highly vulnerable to destruction by the power of synthetic chemicals. The early view of nature as fragile, that is, easily disrupted and unable to repair itself, has been tempered somewhat by evidence that many ecosystems are more resilient and can adapt to changed circumstances. But whether fragile or robust, the Earth has been understood as unresponsive, neutral, and essentially benign. This understanding has various expressions, including the notion of living harmoniously with nature, an idea drawn from images of pre-industrial peoples living close to the natural world. Mother Earth is nurturing, feminine, and easily damaged. Underlying these conceptions is a view that while humans can cause a great deal of damage, nature is passive and always our victim. Yet now we see that the planet has been disturbed from its resting state, jolted out of the providential era of climatic stability characteristic of the last 10,000 years, and is now on a new and largely uncontrollable path that's creating conditions dangerous for human life. The Earth is now understood as a dynamic system with strong feedback effects that can suddenly shift it to a new state when critical points are crossed. So the new science turns upside down how we think about our relationship to the planet. We must no longer see the Earth as the submissive repository for supplying our resources and taking our wastes, nor as the docile victim of our rapacity and carelessness. The new understanding of the Earth has been expressed most vividly and bluntly by the legendary paleoclimatologist Wally Brocker when he wrote, "The paleoclimate record shouts out to us that far from being self-stabilising, the Earth's climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts even to small nudges." When the Earth is understood this way, the task of environmentalism can no longer be to save the planet, for the planet we wanted to save has become something else, not the kind of thing that can be preserved. Our task now is to do what we can to pacify, or at least not aggravate further, something vastly more powerful than we are and whose psychology, if I can put it that way, we can barely understand. If we've wakened the slumbering beast by poking and prodding it, the prudent course is firstly to stop. But we can't put it back to sleep. It's too late for that. There's no return to the peaceful conditions of the Holocene, at least not for thousands of years, probably tens of thousands of years. But to provoke the slumbering or now awakened beast further is foolishness on an epic scale. Yes, the Earth still demands our respect, but it's a respect founded on trepidation rather than love. If we're inclined to think of the planet, as many are, in terms of Gaia, we would do better to regard it not as the all-loving, all-nurturing Mother Earth of the Romantics, but more like the half-crazed, bloodthirsty and vindictive goddess of the original Greek tales. Now, some believe we must negotiate a new contract with nature. Under the terms of this natural contract, humanity would reject notions of mastery and, in Michelle Serres' words, in favour of admiring attention, reciprocity, contemplation and respect. The contract would grant nature rights and make reparations. 20 years ago, that kind of thinking seemed to make sense. It was a view I certainly had. But today we must ask whether the Earth, roused from its slumber, is in any mood to sign a contract with us. Now, it's often said that the first full image of the blue planet, taken by the Apollo 17 space mission in December 1972, revealed the Earth to be precious, fragile, and protected only by a wafer-thin atmospheric layer. It reinforced the imperative for better stewardship of our only home. But there was another way of seeing the Earth, revealed by those photographs. For some, the image showed the Earth, for the first time, as a total object, a knowable system, and it validated the instrumentalist belief that the planet is there to be used for our own ends. In this way, the blue planet image was not a break from technological thinking, but its affirmation. So for people who began to see it that way, the planet as a cybernetic system, the Apollo 17 photograph legitimised the Earth as the domain of technological manipulation, a domain from which any unknowable and unanalysable element had been banished. And it prompts the idea that the Earth as a whole could be subject to regulation. And the kinds of technological intervention envisaged by those who imagine the world to be subject to technological regulation, the kinds of technologies fall under the rubric of geoengineering. Geoengineering is the deliberate large-scale intervention in the climate system designed to counter global warming or offset some of its effects. While some proposed schemes are modest and relatively benign, the more ambitious ones would see humanity mobilising its technological power to seize control of the climate system. And of course, because the climate system can't be separated from the rest of the Earth system, that means controlling the planet, probably in perpetuity. While some proposals, such as launching a cloud of mirrors into space to deflect some of the sun's heat, sound like science fiction, the more serious schemes require no great technical feat. Two or three leading ones rely on technologies readily available and could be deployed within months. And they include the geoengineering schemes known as ocean iron fertilisation and sulphate aerosol spraying, each of which now has a substantial scientific commercial constituency. Technologies of planetary control immediately raise the question of who would have their hand on the thermostat. Now, as you might know, it's not, well, of course, when you ask that question, you know it's not going to be the Bangladeshi rice farmers who are going to be most affected by global warming, but more like the Pentagon or the Chinese military. Generals, of course, have always dreamed of controlling the weather, what Napoleon wouldn't have done if he could have countered Russia's winter. And indeed, in the Cold War, both sides invested heavily in research to manipulate the weather for military purposes, leading eventually to a treaty called ENMOD, which outlaws the hostile use of weather modification. And so the military is keeping a close watch on geoengineering because of its far-reaching strategic implications. Now, geoengineering is often referred to as Plan B, one we should be ready to deploy because Plan A, cutting global greenhouse gas emissions, seems unlikely to be implemented in time. Others are working on what might be called Plan C. And it was announced in the Times in these terms. British scientists and architects are working on plans for a living spaceship like an interstellar Noah's Ark that will launch in 100 years' time to carry humans away from a dying Earth. And they've called it Project Persephone, which is kind of odd because in Greek mythology, Persephone is the queen of the dead. And its website announces that its goal is to build what they call an exovivarium, a prototype exovivarium, that is a closed ecosystem inside a satellite to be maintained from Earth telebotically. I don't know what that means, but you can have a good guess. And they add, democratically governed by a global community. Pull the other one. According to Project Persephone's sociologist, Steve Fuller, if the Earth ends up a no-go zone for human beings due to climate change or nuclear or biological warfare, we have to preserve human civilization. Why would we have to preserve human civilization? What's the value of a civilization if not to raise human beings to a higher level of intellectual sophistication and moral responsibility? What is a civilization worth if it cannot protect the natural conditions that gave birth to it? Those who fly off, leaving behind a ruined Earth, would carry into space a fallen civilization. He's now mostly forgotten, but in the 1950s and 60s, the Swedish poet Harry Martinson was famous for his haunting epic poem, Aniara. He told the story of a spaceship carrying a community of several thousand humans out into space, escaping an Earth devastated by nuclear conflagration. At the end of the epic, the spaceship's controller laments the failure to create a new Eden. So Martinson writes, I had meant to make them an Edenic place, but since we left the one we had destroyed, our only home became the night of space, where no God heard us in the endless void. So, from the cruel fantasy of Plan C, we're obliged to return to Plan A and do all we can to slow the geological clock. If, on this earthen beast provoked, a return to the halcyon days of the Holocene is no longer possible, at least we can resolve to calm the Anthropocene's agitations and so make this new and unwanted geological epoch one in which humans can survive. Thank you.
On Big Ideas on RN or online at abc.net.au/RN, you're listening to Clive Hamilton at the Sydney Writers' Festival delivering the third annual Dr. Eric Dark Lecture, Can Humans Survive the Anthropocene? Following his talk, Clive Hamilton sat down with Greg Borschmann, Environment Editor for RN Breakfast, to consider how to respond to climate change and whether geoengineering is an appropriate or viable option.
Clive Hamilton, I'd like to personalise this a little bit. I'd like to know where all this started, because presumably in the bosom of family you weren't writing books about the Anthropocene or climate change when you were 5 years old. Where did it all come from?
Essentially, I mean, I've been writing books about climate change and papers and other things for about going on 20 years. The first was mainly to do with the sort of economic policy, increasingly on the politics of climate change, the contours and influence of climate denialism. And then a few years ago, 2008, I was sitting in my office and, you know, I read quite a bit of climate science. I don't have any expertise in it. I only have high school science. But I tell you what, it's astonishing how much of it I use now. It's amazing. I didn't like science at all. Just that very basic science, how much of it I now draw on. But, I was sitting in my office in 2008, and I was reading the article by Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes, two climate scientists from University of Manchester then, I think. And they had just presented the task facing the world in a very... They presented it in a different way. They present the numbers in a very kind of compelling way. And it just became apparent to me, I can remember the instant actually, when I was reading this article, and it suddenly hit me that limiting warming to 2 degrees is impossible, and that even under an optimistic set of assumptions about the alacrity and seriousness with which the countries of the world might act and reduce climate change emissions, we're probably going for 4 degrees plus. And when I read this, I just had one of the, what's known colloquially as an oh shit moment. And I'm sure a lot of people in this room have had that one way or another, not necessarily reading a scientific article, but it could be listening to someone or just a newspaper article or just, you know, you're at a quiet moment and just all of the stuff you've read and heard, it just suddenly comes together and you say, oh shit. You know, this is not like a normal problem that we can solve. We really are in trouble. And that was kind of a, you know, an emotional tipping point for me, because human beings are brilliant at deploying strategies to fend off these kinds of realizations. I mean, no one wants to go there. It's not a pleasant place to be. It's depressing. In fact, I went into a kind of depression for, you know, probably a year. It wasn't a pleasant experience then writing the book, Requiem for a Species. And, you know, usually when you write a book, you know, and you send off the final edited manuscript to the publishers, and then there's kind of not much for you to do for about 5 or 6 months while they get their act together, and you might do the index or something like that. And then suddenly it's, you know, the book appears and you go on a book tour and you're like events like this and you talk about your book. And as the publication date and previously, you know, the book tour is, you know, the highlight of a sort of author's life. You go out and you meet people and it's stimulating and people say interesting things. You know, I'll put that in the next book. But this time I thought, I really don't want to go out and talk about this book. You know, it's not something I want to talk about. And so in a way, the most confronting moment for me, confronting is not the right word, disturbing moment, was when I was giving a talk and my two kids came. They are in their 20s. I thought, I really don't want to be saying this to my children. Somebody else can say it, but I don't want to say it. So that's where it came from.
Can we talk about what you and others have called the good Anthropocene? Many would think that what you've outlined tonight is somewhat Orwellian, if not totally terrifying, but there are clearly some who rather like the prospect of spaceships and Plan Cs, not just to fix climate change, but almost the ultimate extension of biblical dominion. What is this concept of the good Anthropocene? Where did it all come from?
Well, it came from a man called Earl Ellis, a US ecologist, who is at the centre of a group of US, and I think they're almost exclusively US, and I think that matters because of the kind of genetically imprinted optimism that being an American entails, techno-optimism. There's a group of people who say, you know, all of this stuff, you know, I showed that great acceleration thing, and the work by the earth scientists who developed the idea, Paul Crutzen, Will Steffen, Jan Zalasiewicz, and a bunch of others, who all, you know, who present it all with a great sense of foreboding. I mean, if you start messing with the earth's fundamental natural processes, I mean, this is a very dangerous enterprise. But no, there's this group of so-called eco-pragmatists in the United States, particularly gathered around a think tank known as the Breakthrough Institute, that say, look, we should embrace the Anthropocene as the good Anthropocene, because yes, humans have caused some environmental damage, but hey, look, we're a species that's flourished and we've created all these incredible things. You know, we have iPhones and air travel and space travel and so on. The arrival of the Anthropocene should be grasped with two hands, because it's an opportunity for human beings to come into their own fully. To use our creativity and our technological capability to take control of the planet as a whole and regulate it to suit our needs.
But there's something else going on, isn't there? Because conservative US think tanks, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heartland Institute, they've been at the front line for a decade or more of climate denial, but you're saying they're now shifting. What's this change? What's driving it?
Well, this is one of the bizarre things I noticed while writing the book on geoengineering, that these right-wing think tanks in the United States, which have been at the absolute forefront of promoting climate denial, and, you know, we feel their influence very strongly in Australia because they have effective outreach programs. I mean, the IPA didn't generate its ideas itself. It got them from kindred right-wing think tanks in the United States, and I and others have tracked the links. So this campaign of denying the science of climate change and denigrating climate scientists, attacking their professional integrity, has came out of these think tanks. They've been highly effective in the United States and to some extent here. And so here's this bizarre thing. Suddenly, these organisations like Cato and the American Enterprise Institute start publishing papers promoting geoengineering. Now, this sounds like a profound paradox. How can you promote a solution for a problem you say doesn't exist? But I think it tells you something that we've kind of always known, but it's become very blatant. And in fact, that is that it's not about the science. It has never been about the science. That the denialists have consciously pursued a strategy of casting doubt on the science, of being merchants of doubt, in the book title of Naomi Oreskes's brilliant book, which exposes where all this came from. And so bottom line is, if a solution that they find acceptable is available, then they'll own up to the problem. And when you think about geoengineering as opposed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions, it seems to tick all of their boxes. It's a sort of spit in the eye for all of those greenies. It's a grand technological intervention. It's the ultimate expression of mastery. It doesn't require carbon taxes. It doesn't require fossil fuel companies to be tackled. It kind of a sort of a magic solution.
And it's business as usual.
It's business as usual. And so it not only protects the system as it currently exists, it's a kind of vindication of the system. And that's why you've got this apparent paradox.
There's an unexpected Australian connection here too. You've documented how in 2010 the Victorian government bankrolled the key scientific meeting in the United States, which laid out the principles for research into climate engineering techniques. Yet that state government then got cold feet about sponsoring a similar event in Australia. Is there any enthusiasm or work currently looking at geoengineering in Australia, at least that you're aware of?
Yeah, that was kind of a very weird situation, that there was this big geoengineering conference held at Asilomar in California, and all of the geoengineering people engaged in it and some commercial interests turned up. And then it emerged that the Victorian government, this little old state in this country in the Southern Hemisphere, was the principal financial backer. And I actually investigated this, and the Victorian government had a kind of technology ambassador in San Francisco whose idea was to report back on what's happening in the US in the technology field. And he reported back, and he was a former MP. He said, oh, look, there's this great new geoengineering thing going on. I think, you know, the Department of Industry should get involved. And so they put in, I think, $200,000. And so, but when I said I wanted to write about this, because I'd heard from someone who was there and who had been speaking to the Victorian government that they were going to hold an Asilomar conference in Asia, you know, the same kind of thing. They hold it in Australia for Asian people from the region. But as soon as I rang up and started to speak to the relevant people, they suddenly realised why it took them so long, I cannot understand, that the optics of the state in the world producing the dirtiest form of fossil energy, brown coal, should be funding a geoengineering conference were actually really terrible. And that's when they got cold feet. There are a number of scientists in Australia who are doing desk-based research on geoengineering. I think it's probably true to say that most of those who are quite sceptical about geoengineering. There's been zero expression of political interest in geoengineering in Australia. However, I'm told by a very reliable authority that our current Environment Minister, Greg Hunt, is in private an enthusiast for geoengineering.
Well, we'll certainly have to ask the Minister about that one. But what we do know, and perhaps surprisingly, is that the Obama administration has been wrestling with this. In the president's first term, his science advisor, John Holdren, candidly revealed that geoengineering was being vigorously discussed as an emergency option. But that push went nowhere, and the administration was forced to backtrack. Are you saying that was only temporary?
Well, no, I'm saying that, well, yes and no. I mean, they are discussing it, or have been discussing it, and I'm told that on the Hill in Washington, particularly increasingly in the offices of Republican members of Congress, there is serious interest in geoengineering. But, I mean, this is an extremely important point, which, you know, if you listen to me, you'll get a different impression. I have to keep reminding myself to say this because it's crucially important. There are some people, like Paul Crutzen, who comes up again because he wrote a crucial article in 2006 saying...
They're not climate deniers.
Not only are they not climate deniers, but someone like Paul Crutzen, he's been described in Time magazine as the chief caretaker of life on planet Earth. I mean, he's a climate scientist who's extremely concerned about the implications of global warming.
So he thinks we've missed the bus, clearly. So
he does, and he says we must have Plan B, sulfate aerosol spraying, because to deploy in a climate emergency, which might occur in, well, who knows, 10 or 30 years' time, because we may cross a tipping point where such rapid warming occurs, which is an irretrievable situation. And if we're approaching that point, even though it's someone like Crutzen would do it extremely reluctantly, we might have to deploy the sulfate aerosol spraying because the alternative is just so unthinkable that we have to do it. So there are some people like John Holdren and Paul Crutzen who are extremely serious and worried about climate change. I mean, John Holdren has been a very powerful influence in the Obama White House pushing Obama to take stronger action on climate change. I'm guessing he must have just about resigned in the first term out of frustration. Now Obama is taking it more seriously, and he's probably feeling vindicated. But there are genuinely concerned environmental scientists, climate scientists, who say, I hate doing this, but we have to be prepared. We need to work on this Plan B.
And I guess that's the bizarre thing about geoengineering, because it does have some odd bedfellows. In 2010, Russia joined with Japan in an attempt to water down a resolution to restrict research into geoengineering at a meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity, and last year Russia made a determined effort to have the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, talk up the benefits of geoengineering in its latest adaptation report that came out earlier this year. So where are we at globally or politically with this? Because we have a meeting in Paris next year which is meant to thrash out a new global climate treaty. This is the big moment. This is when we will determine where we go from 2020. And you're saying that there are fears that geoengineering could derail this moment. Why?
Well, the State Department in the US is doing more and more work on geoengineering and developing its links and sorting through its position. I mean, the US doesn't have a position on geoengineering. No country has a position on geoengineering. Except perhaps Russia, but that's just one man. And it's not Putin, it's a man called Yuri Israel, who speaks for Russia on climate change. This is an extremely important point. So the State Department is worried that at the next conference of the parties, which I think is in Peru in November, but particularly in Paris, November of next year, momentum towards a global agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions could be derailed by someone throwing a geoengineering hand grenade into the negotiations.
In other words, why bother? Because we've got a solution here for you.
Yes, exactly. But all hell will break loose. You mentioned the Convention on Biodiversity. A group of nations of the South, a number from South America and a number from Southeast Asia, with support of one or two Scandinavian countries, have formed a bloc in the Convention on Biodiversity, which will carry over to the Framework Convention on Climate Change, to impose severe limits on research into geoengineering, particularly ocean iron fertilisation, but they'd like to extend it to others. And so already we're starting to see, kind of behind the scenes, a positioning of various nations. And the reason for this is that Paul Crutzen wrote that 2006 article I mentioned, which broke the taboo for scientists on talking about geoengineering. Basically, there'd be a bit of talk, you know, behind the scenes, you know, in the coffee breaks at conferences, but no scientists would talk really about geoengineering. There was the odd one, but basically there was a taboo on it for exactly this reason, so-called moral hazard, that if we talk about it, it will give the big polluters an excuse not to pursue plan A. And so we are not going to talk, and there was no sort of agreement. It was just kind of a generalized understanding that it would be dangerous to talk about it. Then Crutzen wrote his famous article in 2006, and given his eminence, it kind of opened the floodgates. And then there's, if you track the number of articles on geoengineering published in the professional literature, you can see it goes to 2006 and just goes, whoa. I was speaking to one scientist about 2008. He said, you can read all of the articles published on geoengineering in one transatlantic flight. It was then a bit of an exaggeration, but it'd be impossible now. You'd have to have several around the world tickets. So what we're waiting for now, trembling, is for the political floodgates to open, because there's a taboo politically. I mean, Greg Hunt isn't going to come out and say, I think we should pursue sulfate aerosol spraying. That's part of our direct action plan. And certainly Obama's not going to say it, and not even the Republican leader is going to say it, because it would seem to be such a betrayal of the responsibility, particularly on the major nations, to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, that no one is willing to do it. But once one or two nations start, serious nations start to talk about it, then kind of all bets are off. Well, they're talking about it, so we have to talk about it.
Clive, two questions to finish with. The first is about the nature of environmental protest. One of the criticisms of environmental or political protests, especially on climate change, is that it's ideological. It's seen as or painted as a conspiracy almost to bring down the existing world order, or at least it's seen as an attack on free market capitalism. As fantastic as that may sound, is there an element of inadvertent truth in it? Because as you've just explained tonight, in the pursuit of a planetary peace deal, that's going to involve some massive shifts, because business as usual isn't going to work, is it?
Well, it depends a bit on what we mean by business as usual. Certainly, there's no question that sharply cutting greenhouse gas emissions in a way consistent with the science will severely erode the wealth and power of fossil fuel-based corporations. So there'll be a major shift in the energy economy, and that's why fossil fuel corporations lead the charge. That's why
18 of the world's top 20 global corporations by revenue are into fossil fuels, either oil or gas or coal.
And 90% of the money that backs climate science denial comes from fossil fuel corporations or related individuals or trusts. There has never been a more powerful corporate force that has to be defeated in order to undertake an essential policy change. On the other hand, I'm a member of the Australian government's principal climate policy advisory body, the Climate Change Authority, which still exists but may not in 3 months or so. The Abbott government has sworn that it will abolish it. Our future is now in the hands of Clive Palmer. But the Climate Change Authority produced a report a month or two ago on Australia's future emission reduction trajectory. And it recommended that Australia should reduce its carbon emissions not by 5%, which is still the bipartisan policy, by 2020, but by 19% by 2020 and by 40 to 60% by 2030, and that would put us on a path to reducing our emissions to a level that would be our fair contribution to global efforts. And we got Treasury to analyse the economic impact of pursuing this radical path of emission reductions. This authority, I'll remind people, is chaired by Bernie Fraser. And so the Treasury ran these trajectories, these policy paths through their fairly sophisticated economic model, and they concluded that the cost to gross national income of pursuing these policies compared to business as usual would be so small that no one would notice it. So small, Treasury, I should say, did not say this, I'm saying this, but it's nevertheless true, so small that it would be less than the measurement error in GDP. I mean, it would be tiny to bring about in terms of economic cost. The political cost would be substantial, and of course the cost to those powerful corporations would be very substantial indeed.
And therein lies the problem.
Clive Hamilton, I'd like to finish where we started on a personal note. My RN colleague Geraldine Doogue, reviewing your book Affluenza, praised your fearless warts and all pursuit of these confronting issues, which she said was, quote, accompanied by passion, which is why the results cannot be ignored. I'm wondering what price you've paid for that passion. I mean, for example, have you ever had a death threat?
Yes. And so, you know, when I ran the Australia Institute, there were a couple of times when we called in the police. And, you know, there have been times when I've walked out my front door and looked across the road at the trees and thought, am I being paranoid? I'd better be careful. So there are denialists who adopt extremely aggressive tactics, but there are also thuggish parliamentarians who will use parliamentary privilege to launch highly defamatory attacks on someone's character in a way that there's virtually no comeback, a deliberate, calculated attempt to use parliamentary privilege to defame and traduce me. Now, you know, obviously I don't like that, but, you know, I make the point that you mustn't retreat under these attacks because they win and because you have to maintain your integrity in these situations. Now, I'm a privileged person. I'm in a position where, you know, I have secure, touchwood, employment. Lord Monckton wrote to my vice-chancellor when I said something about him, outraged and demanding that I'd be dismissed. Of course, it wasn't taken seriously. So I am in a privileged position to be able to do this, but, you know, if you care, you've got to stand up.
On that note...
Clive Hamilton, Professor of Public Ethics at Charles Sturt University, with RN Breakfast's environment editor, Greg Borschmann. During that conversation, Clive Hamilton suggested that, in private, Minister Greg Hunt was an enthusiast for geoengineering. As promised, Big Ideas put a series of questions on geoengineering to the Environment Minister, Greg Hunt. The Minister replied, quote, I think we'd have to be exceptionally careful about any proposal. There is none before me at the moment, and so there is no specific proposal to review. However, the basis for any consideration would be a firm application of the precautionary principle. That's Environment Minister Greg Hunt.
A new segment this week on the Sunday Extra podcast, George Brandis Explains Things. Well, not really, but we do have a crack at making sense of metadata and data retention. Effective tools in the war on terror? Our On the Contrary debaters look at bigotry, outsiders, and a peek inside the mysterious world of the Japanese Love Hotel. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.